It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Today, we end our stay in the Bronze Age with a trip back up north, to the edges of the old world. We're visiting a place called Clad Helen, at least, I hope that's how it's pronounced. We don't need another Englishman insulting the Scots. And that's where we are. Scotland, in the Western Isles, a place of oceans, islands, and some of the best whiskey in the world. Go and pour yourself a glass of something smoky. This episode could get a bit creepy. At Clad Helen, there is a village just on the edge of the beach, buried for 3,000 years beneath the sand. In that village, abandoned at the very end of the Bronze Age, were found dead people. And that's to be expected. This podcast is called Old Bones. These dead people, though, they weren't like the other bodies we've discussed so far. They were well preserved, mummified even. Things get stranger too. These bodies are hundreds of years older than the village, and they're bodies, not people. These mummies weren't made up of one person. Today, we're talking about Bronze Age mummies and ancient plays on Frankenstein's monster. And you see why you might want that drink. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to a slightly freaky episode of Old Bones. Clad Helen is a place to make your skin tingle. When you look out at the ocean, it gazes back, black and stormy. The Western Isles of Scotland are whipped near constantly by storms raging eastward across the Atlantic or bubbling up cold and dreary from the Irish Sea. At night time, huge waves crash against the last beach before the desolation of the ocean. The wind whips across the sand, whistling gently over rustling grass and then screaming into your face. On this shore, alone, you're pulled about by nature. On a moonless night, the Western Isles can make you feel very small indeed. All that madness, the constant tempestuous swirling of storms, it can be addictive. The natural world isn't subdued here, it's not controlled. It grabs you by the shoulders and throws you around. Clad Helen is a place that makes you feel fragile and very, very human. Clad Helen faces out to the ocean. The next land you'd hit, sailing in a straight line from Clad Helen, is Greenland. It's not easy to walk to either. The village is just above the beach, on grassy dunes which are tough to walk across. But that was okay. This wasn't a village you walked to. This was a place you sailed towards. Clad Helen was buried around 1100 BCE, 3,100 years ago. We've jumped forward in time 1200 years since last time. Stonehenge is in its final stages, but Bronze Age technology is at its height. Yes, that means fine metalwork, but it also means the stone plank boats we introduced in the last episode are now commonplace. The sea was the highway, and when you look at the Scottish coastline with that in mind, Clad Helen looks a little less isolated. All that said, there had been many a day that Clad Helen was completely inaccessible, cut off by storms and heavy seas. During the Bronze Age, very few people lived this far north. The greatest population centres lived in the fat lands of southern England, where the hills are gentle and the waters lazy. That's why we get sites like Stonehenge in southern England. It's where a lot of the people and most of the wealth resided. As I said in the last episode, the Bronze Age can appear strikingly modern. Clad Hallan, though, tempestuous and lonesome, asks for a special sort of person. It's the sort of bleakly beautiful place that inspires either devoted loyalty or an itching to leave. That attachment, that isolation, caused some strange behaviour. But on those days when the clouds, waves and rain didn't wreathe Clad Hallan in isolation, it was similar to many places in the Middle and Late Bronze Age. The world continued to be dominated by settlements on rivers and coastlines, connected by waterways that were littered with ships. It's during this period that we have the Salcombe shipwreck off the south coast of England. This suggests that Britain's waterways were covered in sewn plank boats carrying goods, people and ideas throughout these islands. This also means that the North Sea and English Channel were acting as a northern Mediterranean, connecting a ring of landmasses to each other in a way that we just don't get in our nationalistic 21st century world. In a world knitted together by waterways, coastlines become very important. Beaches and sand dunes, places where the land is literally transforming into the seabed, are the source of social connection, wealth, and both danger and salvation. The waters might bring hostile people to your home, but in times when the wind ripped up your crops, it might be that your neighbours brought you food. Beaches are liminal zones in between places, and the people of Clad Hallan seem to have found them very moving. They made the beach a spiritually vibrant place. There's that word again, place. I'm interested to know which words I've used most in this series of the podcast. I think place must be very high up that list. That's because in a world where people lived in the same land for their whole lives, in a world before maps, where the world wasn't a picture but an interconnected web of safe harbours, and in a world where wealth was linked to the resources you could extract, place was everything. It meant something. Names weren't just labels, but descriptors. Place A would have been synonymous with fertility, place B a byword for high-quality fish, and place C a dangerous land not fit for sensible people. There would have been deep social memory tied to certain locations, and again, without the internet or writing, people would have relied on memory to navigate through the world. Place and memory. Quite often those two words meant the same thing, and they helped form people's identity. Identity is a big thing in archaeology. There's a general trend in archaeology and history that people's identity becomes clearer and clearer the more recent the history or archaeology is. It's like the people are literally walking out from the mists of time, becoming more distinct with every step. Part of that is simply the nature of our particular history, which, apart from a few notable exceptions, has generated ever more data as history has advanced. However, it's also because as a society becomes larger and more complex, there becomes a greater need for people to define themselves. Imagine for a second that you're a hunter-gatherer in a band of, say, 15 people. You're all doing pretty much the same job, but one of you will be a slightly more talented butcher, another the best flint napper. Still, another might be a talented artist or seamstress. You might be a good storyteller, whereas still one other might be the mother, the carer of the group. I could go on, but you get the idea. In a small band, you can find a separate identity. It's quite simple when you know so few people to fulfill whatever it is in humans that requires us to have a distinct persona. As a society grows, two seemingly contradictory things happen. The first is that the number of people a person knows, or at least knows of, explodes. Villages get larger and cities and towns become established. The potential people someone might meet in their life goes from 30 or 40 to the thousands of people the average modern person can expect to meet in their life. You and I will meet multiple storytellers, multiple mothers, multiple butchers, all as talented as each other. Post-agriculture, humanity is exposed to a multitude of potential identities, and we're aware, often painfully aware, of all the great stuff other people do. The second thing to happen as a society becomes more complex is that class appears. Some people are farmers, others warriors. We've repeated this list many times already. The main thing is that as societies get more complex, people specialise more and more. That limits the options for building an identity to what a person has the opportunity to learn and what the economy can support. A modern example is that 15 or 16% of young people want to go into the cultural sector, whereas the economy can only support about 3.6% of its population being in that sector. And that's a gap of 11 or 12% of people who aren't going to be able to do the job that they want to do. Another older example is that of a farmer's child. That child won't have the opportunity to learn how to become an artist. The farmer probably doesn't know any artists, and anyway, farming is hard, and the farmer will need the child to work, not learn to paint. As society's roles are filled by specialists, the options to develop an identity are limited the moment you're born. This phenomenon prompts people to ask, how am I different? How am I useful? And how am I special? At the same time, it removes many of the most obvious roles to answering that question. That forces people to look beyond their role for identity. They might find identity in the land they're from or in their family's values. But historically, the greatest source of identity in complex societies has been religion. In the Bronze Age, we're seeing the beginning of this quest for identity. Religion is right there at the outset of this journey. In southern England, Stonehenge is a complex expression of identity for a large number of people. At Cladhallan, we have another more local expression of identity, where the self, a human, was tied directly to the land, the place their descendants lived. The bodies of Cladhallan are an innovative approach to memory and place. The whole of the Bronze Age across the entire Eurasian landmass is a time of innovation. Before we talk about Cladhallan's bodies, let's understand how you get something as strange as this. What is the process for change and innovation? Don't worry, this is still going to be archaeology. We're not becoming a tech startup podcast. Innovation is a process of moving from the known to the unknown. We had phones, and then they got smart. We had carriages and carts, and then we got motor vehicles. Every new thing starts with something already known. There is a world before whatever new thing will be created. It's a world that, because it exists, by definition, already works. However, because it is open to change, it is also, by definition, an imperfect world. Take a flint hand axe. They're brilliant tools. They're wicked sharp, easy to fix when they become blunt, and their raw material, stone, is extremely common. All that said, they do take a long time to make, and they're not very durable. Stone is quite brittle, meaning it doesn't hold an edge for very long and will sometimes, seemingly at random, shatter and become unusable. Farming or wood chopping with flint tools is constantly interrupted by the need to fix or replace your tools. One way to overcome that problem is to increase the quality and quantity of the existing technology. With flint tools, this happened in the late Neolithic. In Suffolk, there is a site called Grimes Graves, and it is an ancient flint mine. The Neolithic people dug deep, up to 40 metres down into the chalk with antler picks. At the bottom of these shafts are pure black, high-quality flint nodules. In Langdale, up in the Lake District in northern England, we see another form of industrialisation. There, they were making polished hand axes, a less sharp but more durable form of stone hand axe. These were being made on a truly industrial scale. The industrialisation of an old process makes high-quality tools available to everyone. In the late Neolithic and early Bronze Age, the production of these tools reached its peak. You can't make stone tools any better than the flint hand axes or Langdale polished hand axes. Everyone knew that it wasn't possible to improve how things were done when it comes to the tools they had. But for now, that's okay. The third step for innovation to take place is to ask a question. For example, imagine if you're a late Neolithic person from West Wales. You might have collected from the river shiny gold rocks. Tiny things, but pretty, dark yellow and forever shining like captured fire. Our proto-Welshman might wonder, what happens if you hit the gold? Try crack it and shape it into something more pleasing. They were already making jewellery out of nice shells or shale rocks, and it's not difficult to see how they might wonder if they could make jewellery out of this rock. they'd begin by hitting it like they did with other rocks. But they'd quickly discover that gold, unlike flint, doesn't shatter. Instead, it bends. Gold allows itself to be squashed. Once that's discovered, you can hammer gold into beautiful shapes and voila, you've got the first form of metalworking. Yeah, it's not true metalworking. There are a few more steps before you stumble upon the metallurgical revolution. The fourth step is to combine what you know of flint with what you've learnt about gold. As far as a Neolithic person knows, gold is found as shining pebbles or as sprawling veins within the mountains. If you know that when you dig, you find more and better flint, it's not a big jump to decide that it might be worth digging to find more and better gold. On these digs, you may also stumble upon other odd-looking rocks. Copper turns things bright green. Now, bright green isn't a colour common amongst real rocks, which tend towards a predictable greyness. You hammer these green rocks and nothing much happens, so you focus instead on digging for more gold. That's where the fifth step comes in. It's the third piece of the innovation triangle. In one corner, we have known objects like gold, malachite, and flint. In another corner, we have known processes like mining and hammering. To complete this triangle, you add a new idea. To continue with our metalworking example, the new idea is the transformative power of fire. This was discovered by noticing how the clay soils beneath a fire often changed colour and turned hard. Some people began trying to form the clay into shapes and then put them in the fires. When those experiments worked, the innovators got pottery, and as we know, when pottery was discovered, it exploded across human society. The people who discovered pottery didn't just discover an inert, waterproof and fireproof storage and cooking vessel. They learned that fire has the power to change things. It can take something wet and soft and turn it into an object which is dry and hard. Once the triangle is complete, questions begin to appear. What if we put flint into the fire? Well, not much. You ruin the stuff. But what if we put the gold into the fire? Well then, you'd learn that it turns soft and becomes easier to work. What if you put those odd, green-looking rocks into the flames? I'll be honest, most of the time nothing. The fires wouldn't get hot enough. Many experiments would fail. But on a rare occasion, the experiments would reveal something remarkable. Maybe one person wanted to see how soft gold could get. They blew on the flames, forced more and more air into the fire, and discovered that if the fire is hot enough, about 1,000 degrees Celsius, the gold turns into liquid. These Neolithic pyrotechnics might try to see what happens if you get the fire really, really hot and put different things into those roaring flames. Let's be honest, we all know plenty of people who would happily spend their entire days trying to burn things. A fire has a draw. It's like a little devil asking us to play with the flames. Those pyrotechnics might throw malachite into the fire and get those flames raging. Copper melts at 1100 degrees Celsius, or thereabouts. You need a very good fire to get it that hot without bellows. You need charcoal, not wood. And you need a near constant source of oxygen, but it is possible. When you discover that burning malachite gives you a different type of gold, a hard type which can be shaped into axes, well, that's something as impactful as the creation of the internet, which, incidentally, is still mostly powered by cables made of copper. After that, like every new edition of the iPhone, it isn't about changing the core product. It's about refining it. You learn that you can cast copper, you can pour it into molds. You discover that hammering the edges makes them harder and more durable. You might also discover that by melting copper and tin together, you get a better material. Bronze. Congratulations, you've ended the Stone Age. That's how you get innovation, and also how metalworking was probably discovered. It's a seven-step process involving improving known things, discovering new ideas, and then combining what you know. Essentially, innovation is playing until something incredible appears. Today's episode isn't about metalworking, though, is it? You're not here for bronze axes today. It's not what you've been promised. Well, in the same way a bronze hand axe makes it easier for humans to manipulate their landscape to improve their life, religion and funerary rites have an equally functional aspect. Religion helps us to create an identity. It helps us find purpose, and remembering the dead ties us to both a community and a place. Religion, by its very nature, is a schismatic thing. Religion and funerary rites are so tied up with how we think about ourselves that we're constantly changing religion to suit what we need. In our ways, we're all mini Henry VIII's, changing the way we interpret what we're taught so that it works for us. We innovate, even when it's considered an unholy thing. Humans can't help being creative. So let's ask, how do you end up following a weirder religious practice as mummification? And why do you combine different human body parts? The answer lies in the process of innovation. Discovering new tools and changing religious beliefs follow the same process. Stick with me. It's a bold claim, but I'm going to show you how. Before explaining how the people of Clad Hallan ended up with mummies, let's introduce you to them, shall we? Don't worry, they're friendly enough. These mummies were laid to rest around 3,120 years ago. To contextualise this period, it's during this time frame that the Eastern Mediterranean is entering the Bronze Age collapse. It's for another series to talk about the details of what happened here. However, it's enough to say that this featured failing crops, earthquake storms, tsunamis, volcanic explosions so violent they ripped apart whole islands, and invasions out of nowhere by the enigmatic sea peoples. So, not a particularly happy time. It's interesting that the trend towards civilization...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Additional collapse happening in the east did echo faintly across to Western Europe. Clad Hallan isn't the only site to be abandoned during this period. Luckily enough for the mummies, they died well before the world turned upside down. We're going to focus on two people, a male and a female. The male skeleton died around 3,600 years ago, 500 years before he was finally buried. The female skeleton died 3,300 years ago, 200 years before she was laid to rest. To contextualise this using modern day examples, this is like having one ancestor who knew Hernandez Cortez, the guy that murdered all those Aztecs, and another ancestor who had fought against Emperor Napoleon hanging about in your house today. I mean, they wouldn't have been very communicative, but they'd have been there, watching what you did, sat on the sofa. Incidentally, the lady mummy died at a similar time to King Tutankhamun. They were really, really old. The reason they could survive for so long was because, as we know, they were mummified. But how on earth did the people of Clad Hallan mummify people? In Egypt, mummification is pretty easy. There's a lot of desert in Egypt, and since there's very little water and quite a lot of heat, bodies desiccate, they dry out. Essentially, a body left in the desert will lose all of its water, meaning all the gross things that help us decompose can't survive, and thus you get no decay. Mummification is a little bit tougher in Peru, the second most famous source of ancient mummies. There, you've got to climb very high up and leave the dead at the top of the mountains. There, they are freeze-dried. It's so cold and so windy at the tippity top of the Andes that all the water is wicked away and frozen out of the bodies. Then they are left dry and preserved. Not sure if you know this, but Britain isn't really a very dry or very cold place. The west coast of the island is especially wet. Even when it's not raining, you can tell the weather's thinking about it. So you can't dry these bodies out. Thankfully, Britain is so wet that it is home to quite a lot of bogs, heavy, marshy land. Much of Scotland is covered in peat bogs. Peat is essentially a lot of stinky, decaying plant matter, which is slowly decomposing, and whilst waiting to decompose, is killing time by acting as a thick sludge. It's horrible, but marvellous stuff. First of all, it's so thick that you can cut it into tiles and use it like bricks. It also burns slowly, making it a passable fuel for fires. Also, when the water passes through it, the water turns this kind of bright brown, like weak tea. And that water makes the best whiskey in the world. Wait here. I fancy a dram. So, the final thing about peat bogs is that they're highly acidic and anaerobic. Peat bogs are so thick and sludgy that literally oxygen cannot work its way in. That's what we mean by anaerobic, without oxygen. In fact, peat bogs are the most effective carbon sinks in the natural world. Trees are great and all, but to save the world, ladies and gentlemen, we need to surround our houses with peat bogs. The unoxygenated, acidic soil does funny things to human flesh. Essentially, it prevents it from going off, mummification. It does this by denaturing the proteins within the body, meaning they can't be consumed or destroyed. Eventually, the acid will dissolve human bones, but anything that is organic, skin, hair, organs, they'll be turned, essentially, into leather. After they died, our two mummies were buried in peat for about 18 months. Then, just before the peat could begin to dissolve the bones, they were removed, cleaned and dried. What remained was her body, wholly preserved. Unfortunately, they were later buried in sand, and that's really not good for preservation, so the skeletons are now defleshed. But when they were finally placed beneath the floor of Clad Helen's roundhouses, they were as lifelike as the day they died. The plural there is useful. You see, it's probable that these bodies were displayed and moved about during their very long afterlife. You've got to be careful with the deceased, otherwise bits can fall off. It appears that, potentially due to accidentally knocking about granddad or grandma, it was necessary to replace parts of their bodies. The male mummy had his skull changed a century after his death, and then the jaw of that new skeleton was replaced 50 years later. That makes sense, right? You've got a special mummy, and when it breaks, you're keen to replace it. However, the female mummy, she was forever a composite. A number of people who died around the same time were mummified together, and then their body parts were fused to create a single mummy. I told you this might get creepy. So now we all know each other. Now we're friends. How did these mummies get to be beneath the floorboards so long after their death? How do you discover mummification? And why do you learn to Frankenstein these people? As I said earlier, there are seven steps. It all begins with a known process. In metalworking, this is flint tools. For religion, that's funerary practices. Burying the dead in important places has been a special part of the human experience for tens of thousands of years. The earliest definite burials are those of the Neanderthals, who were burying their dead in the caves of Iraqi Kurdistan. These were bodies of people who had lived long after suffering disabling issues, or who had been buried in highly ceremonial styles, their bodies covered with flower petals just before being buried. All that to say, caring for the sick and burying the dead in special ways is a very, very old practice. And those practices have changed over time to reflect the different cultures engaging in burials. Over the course of this podcast, we've gone from the burial itself being notable, for example, the relatively simple Paleolithic burial of the Red Lady of Paviland, to burial becoming commonplace in Neolithic sites like West Kennet, Wayland Smithy, and the Tomb of the Eagles. Finally, burial became elaborate and commonplace, as we saw in the last episode, with individual burials covered by large monuments. This is similar to the industrialization we saw with the establishment of sites like Grimes Graves or Langdale, places where a previously special thing, the hand axe, became everyday, democratized. With burials, this stage is especially important. Burying someone is a deep expression of your identity. Initially, it's enough to express that identity by burying those special to you. However, once burying people is just something you do, if you wish to express your identity in a distinct way, you have to innovate. That desire to express your identity leads to a third stage, asking questions. This happened very early with burials. Essentially, the question humans seem to have asked is, how could they use their burials to express a group identity? And this isn't a surprise. We've already seen how much more egalitarian and communal than today earlier human societies were. The answer to that question, how can burials express group identity, was answered in two ways. The first is obvious, we'll bury everyone as a group. Especially in early agricultural communities, humans regularly grouped a lot of their dead together. Remember that desire to create a group identity via human deposition. It'll be important. The second answer is also notable. Humans began to express their group identity by burying people in notable places. Now, notable places have been a key feature of burials forever, but before the Neolithic, those notable places were hidden away. They were in caves. With the advent of agrarian communities, humans began to put their tombs in highly visible places, on top of hills, along ridgeways and natural borders. The dead became territorial guardians or protectors of central places, representing transient people in a permanent, fixed way. The next stage, stage four if you're keeping count, is to combine two ideas. In the Bronze Age, the continuing desire to use burials as an expression of identity met with a greater sense of individuality. Last episode, we discussed how the Amesbury Archer was buried alone and with wealth, and how Gristhorpe Man was buried looking out across the Yorkshire coast. These different burials with different grave goods in different positions speak to a world where people began to see themselves as different, as individuals. In Cladhallan, those two ideas joined up together in a macabre way. People wanted to associate the dead extremely closely with themselves. They wanted to tie their identity to the ancestors, a third idea swimming in this milieu of cultural imperatives. In Cladhallan, the dead ended up beneath your feet, buried beneath the floors of the roundhouses. This suggests that it was culturally important to associate the dead with a place of safety. That's not the innovative bit, though. In Scarborough Brae on Orkney, you got the occasional skeleton beneath a roundhouse. This seems to be a very old Scottish thing to do, to associate your ancestors, your forefathers, with a place of warmth and dry safety in a world of cold, wet danger. Next comes the point of difference, the new discovery that changes everything. At Cladhallan, that's the discovery of the preservative effects of peat bogs. We don't know how they stumbled upon this idea. Maybe someone drowned in a peat bog and they were later discovered, near perfect, many months later. But once this strange phenomenon was discovered, it became popular. The practice of burying the dead in peat bogs spread across the wet world of Northwest Europe. And don't you worry, a full discussion of bog bodies is on its way to you in a very near future episode. What wasn't common was taking the dead back out of the peat a year or two later. Instead of allowing the peat to keep the body perfect forever, the people of Cladhallan took the bodies out and probably kept them on display for centuries after their death. I don't think the mummies we've got were the first ones they made, is what I'm saying. There are 300 years between our male mummy and his female counterpart. They also had those extra elements, suggesting that multiple people were preserved to ensure the mummy's survival. All of this suggests a degree of experimentation. Humans had to learn that leaving the bodies in the peat too long led to the bodies crumbling and their mummies becoming leather bags, not eternally serene bodies. They would have also learned that taking them out too soon didn't preserve people well enough and they began to crumble. But they learned from their mistakes and eventually they got it right. Once they'd learned the practice, they began refining the process, and I think it's from these improvements that we get the extra body parts. They weren't just refining the mummification process, they were also refining the mummies. And that, my friends, is the dark and twisted way of innovation. It's the same process underlying the discovery of metalwork and the development of Bronze Age mummies. It's how humans can go from cave burials to mummies beneath the floorboards. As always, though, it's not enough to just understand how these mummies came into existence. We've got to understand why. Every human action has a reason, whether it's a conscious or unconscious one. It's our job to uncover those reasons and to see what they teach us about human nature. Even the weird bits. No, sorry. Especially the weird bits. Take five. Grab a drink. Pour yourself a whiskey. We're asking those questions next. The mummification at Cladhallan isn't normal. Usually I'm able to spin odd behaviour as some paradoxical evidence of interconnected separation or a world defined by its consistent diversity. However, even when it comes to the bog bodies of the Late Bronze Age and Iron Age, Cladhallan is different. Less than 1% of all Bronze Age burials in Britain show even a hint of the same process. It's a weird thing to do, and Cladhallan is a unique and weird place. However, as I think we've suggested, that doesn't mean mummification isn't born from some pretty familiar trends. Ancestor worship is an obvious one, as is the desire to use the dead to mark special places, using their bodies and souls as monuments and as sources of individual and group identity. Let's explore things more deeply. Let's try and use this oddity to uncover more about what it meant to be human in the Middle and Late Bronze Age. To begin with, buried underneath the roundhouse was a male mummy, a female mummy, and two non-mummified children. These burials were deliberate, and we have to assume represent the total sum of burials beneath the final version of Clad Hallam. This strikes me as an obvious holy family setup. Not exactly like Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, but like Isis and Osiris, or Zeus and Hera. During the Late Bronze Age in the Eastern Mediterranean, storm gods, usually male, and important goddesses of fertility, usually female, became very popular. Entire religions were built around a male-female father-mother duality. Zeus and Hera, the more famous Greek gods, are more recent echoes of that Bronze Age belief. Only a few hundred years after Clad Hallam fell into disrepair, a group of migrating herdsmen living in Palestine would begin telling stories of a founding couple who were the mother and father of all humanity. They were called Adam and Eve. It might be that we are seeing a similar explanation at Clad Hallam for the source of all humanity. I find this a seductive interpretation of the mummies. It would be odd if the people of Clad Hallam didn't have some sort of storm god, since storms are a defining and threatening feature of the environment. By the same token, such an ecologically poor and ocean-dependent area must have been willing to do anything to promote and protect the land's fertility. A bubbling of seven round houses with some skeletons in the foundations isn't enough evidence to recreate a whole religion. However, for the last few episodes, we have been seeing echoes, cultural wavelets from the Eastern Mediterranean lapping against Britain's shores. If we're to consider these people as complex and interconnected, we have to entertain the possibility that they shared some core cultural concepts with the people they were connected with. One of those core concepts was perhaps a religion based around a male-female, destruction versus creation, stone and wood, water and land duality. We see similar themes at Stonehenge and Durrington Walls, and it may be that the mummies were physical representations of a concept merely inferred at in other places. A more obvious interpretation is that they are quite literal reminders of the past existence of other humans, closely related to the currently living. Whereas Stonehenge created a whole narrative to remind people of life, death, and the presence and power of ancestors, the people of Clad Hallam may have used the advantages of their landscape to create a very direct reminder of the power of the ancestors. The mummies may have been seen as liminal people, not living, but not fully dead. Instead, they were a conduit between the world of the living and that of the ancestors. The mummies were maintained so that the connection was preserved, but also so that the status of the mummies amongst the ancestors was preserved. That connection could have been tied to a similar phenomena we've just discussed, keeping the fields fertile and the storms at bay. In this way, they may have been similar to the Inca mummies. The mummified Incan emperors continued to give advice to their successor emperors until the Spanish destroyed them as a pagan barbarianism. In a connected way, these bodies may have acted as a memento mori. In a world where death was just one giant wave away, the mummies may have acted as a simple reminder of the precariousness of life, helping the people of Clad Hallam accept the risks they took by simply living on the islands. That same reminder of the closeness of death might also have reminded the people of the value of home and the importance of social cohesion. If there's one thing that brings people together, it's a shared fear. The terror of a sudden, brutal storm might have tied the community together. These are ideas supported by the final burial of the bodies beneath the floors, in their houses, their squat homes that forced them close together and kept them safe from the worst of the weather. Yes, it was weird, but it made the people of Clad Hallam proud of their community and of their homes. Perhaps it was a brutal, dangerous place, but it was their brutal, dangerous place. Every generation fundamentally understood the importance of that internal communal harmony, the value of having a safe place to retreat to when things became too difficult. They preserved the mummies for centuries, possibly for more than 15 generations. Each generation decided to keep the faith with a belief system and community that had kept their immediate ancestors safe. When those mummies began to crumble with age, they preserved them, preserved the connection to their past, to their community, and to their homes. Or it could be a combination of some or all of these theories. That's something we've not had a chance to say for a few episodes. It's impossible for me to escape the nagging suspicion that these mummies gave to different people very different things. Some saw them as mother and father, and some saw them as talismans of home and safety, others as monuments to their ancestors, and still others as connections to their society. People got from them what they needed, but in a world where things changed a lot, where danger and famine were never too far away, these seemingly eternal figures provided comfort, security, and consistency. Unfortunately, though, despite the power of the mummies, despite the consistency they represented, Clanhallan came to an end. It was abandoned like so much else in Europe 3,100 years ago. The sand reclaimed the world. With the end of Clanhallan also came the end of Stonehenge and the end of the Bronze Age civilizations all across the Afro-Eurasian landmass. The Bronze Age was a period that started with a whimper, a nervous emergence from the Stone Age. It ended with a cacophony of bangs, war, floods, landslides, volcanic eruptions, and earthquakes. What replaced the Bronze Age was a dark time, a time of scattered people and a near-empty archaeological record. That said, things never truly disappear. Much of what made the Bronze Age great survived, hidden in epic stories, funerary traditions, or social organisation. One of the Bronze Age traditions that survived was the use of peat bogs to dispose of the dead. There's no more mummies to discuss, no more of Frankenstein's monsters, but in places like Clanhallan, there began a tradition of bog bodies that will continue until the Romans arrive. The most famous British bog body is that of Lundo Mam, our last episode of this season. We're entering the final stages of season one. It's a wild ride to the finish. You'll want to subscribe or join me on Patreon. And if you've enjoyed visiting Clanhallan with me, do leave a review. Our next episode will begin in shadow and uncertainty as we try and piece together the early Iron Age from the summits of Britain's hill forts. On top of these vast enigmatic hills, we'll find the beginnings of my family tree, the seeds for the rise of one of Europe's greatest cultures. The Iron Age is the time of the Celts. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones. See you soon. Thank you.